Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we'll have the latest on that hepatitis outbreak, which has now spread to communities in East County. An El Cajon councilman is drawing criticism from First Amendment legal experts after threatening to sue a San Diego Union-Tribune reporter, dishing out personal insults and demanding that the reporter not contact the councilman, his wife, members, or sponsors of a chamber of commerce that he founded. On Crime Beat, hear about a local pot shop owner who's been arrested in Spring Valley. Then we have some sad news for coffee lovers in La Mesa, where a popular coffee house and open mic night venue has closed. In El Cajon, a pilot and co-pilot are safe after a crash landing. On People Power, hear what lengths San Miguel firefighters went to rescue a trapped kitten. Plus, we have good news for sports fans about a new ABA team in San Diego. On Destination East County, hear about top festivals and events from Julian's Apple Days to Oktoberfests, the Borrego Days Desert Festival, and more coming up across East County. On the second half of our show today, we'll be focusing on national and international news stories of interest to many local residents, including the latest on devastation wrought by that 7.1 earthquake in Mexico and Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. We'll have reports on revival efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, the controversy over Russian-backed ads on Facebook, and relief efforts to provide long-term help for survivors of Hurricane Harvey in Texas. Plus, hear about controversies over a bill on the governor's desk to take away local control over siting of 5G wireless. And finally, we'll be replaying one of our Best of East County episodes, an interview with the late, great Gary McClintock on the history of vaqueros. So stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Gene Carpenter with a health report. San Diego County's outbreak of hepatitis A now includes cases in La Mesa, El Cajon, and Santee, as well as unincorporated areas, though cases have now been confirmed in all parts of the county, according to a California Health Alert bulletin. 8 cases have been confirmed in La Mesa, according to city manager Yvonne Garrett. In El Cajon, the city has worked with the county to bring in hand-washing stations in public places. The city of San Diego has opened public restrooms, added hand-washing stations, and power wash streets to sanitize public areas. The county has declared a public health emergency due to the outbreak. 421 local cases have been reported, including hundreds hospitalized and 16 deaths. Most cases involve homeless people or IV drug users, though 23% of cases do not fall into either of those categories. Clusters have been reported among people who use the same homeless service providers, as well as in jails, single-room occupancy hotels, residential drug treatment facilities, group homes, and assisted living facilities. 4 healthcare workers have contracted hepatitis A during this outbreak, as have 6 food handlers. Diners who ate at the world-famous restaurant in Pacific Beach between August 28th and September 11th may have been exposed to the disease. Also troubling, 20% of those patients also had chronic hepatitis C infection, and 5% have chronic hepatitis B infection. To reduce your risk of contracting hepatitis A, wash your hands frequently and avoid touching doorknobs or sink handles in public restrooms. The disease can also be transmitted through shared food, drinks, or eating utensils, sharing cigarettes or drug needles, and through sexual contact. The disease is contagious from 2 weeks before symptoms develop until a week or more after. Symptoms include nausea, jaundice, fever, and abdominal discomfort. The disease may resolve with no permanent effects, but can sometimes cause liver damage or even death. Alcohol-based wipes and disinfectants are not effective against this strain of hepatitis A, so washing hands with soap and warm water for at least 20 seconds is important. The hepatitis A vaccine is also advised for anyone at risk. None of the local cases involved people who were vaccinated. Under the Affordable Care Act, hepatitis A vaccines are covered as preventive care without a deductible or a copay. The vaccine is also covered by Medi-Cal without prior authorization.
This is Miriam Raftery with a special report from El Cajon, where Councilman Ben Colasso is drawing criticism from First Amendment experts for the bullying tone of emails that he sent to an award-winning journalist at the San Diego Union-Tribune. Colasso repeatedly called reporter Jeff McDonald a troll and threatened legal action after McDonald asked tough questions about Colasso's business dealings and apparent conflicts of interest. The councilman also demanded that McDonald stop contacting Colasso, Colasso's wife, members of the Chamber of Commerce that he founded, and its sponsors by any means, which would include his official public email address, adding that any future contact would be used against McDonald in an upcoming harassment claim. Colasso also accused the reporter of, quote, acts of deception, unquote, and fabricating information. Now, Colasso's wife became president of the San Diego Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce after Colasso was elected to the council. The Union Tribune inquiry included questions regarding Colasso's vote on tax liens against residents over unpaid bills to Waste Management. Waste Management paid $2,500 to the chamber that Colasso started and that his wife heads up as a corporate member, and it is unclear why Colasso did not recuse himself from that vote, since council members are required to do so whenever they have a financial conflict involving money paid to themselves or their family members. California's Attorney General has also sent Colasso a letter probing the lack of nonprofit papers filed for the Miss Middle East beauty pageant that he has run, as we have reported. The emails released by the reporter, McDonald, between himself and Colasso showed that McDonald remained professional in tone even after Colasso's insults and dodging of important questions on matters that are clearly of strong public interest. McDonald has published a series of reports on Colasso's controversies, but after the reporter revealed that Waste Management had withdrawn its sponsorship of Colasso's chamber, Colasso accused McDonald of making up the story. Now, Waste Management Senior Communications Manager Eloise Orozco confirmed to East County Magazine's reporter Paul Cruz that Waste Management did indeed withdraw its support, stating, "We're not entirely comfortable contributing to an organization which is involved in a controversy." Colasso's chamber has been embroiled in multiple controversies. After losing a trademark dispute over the name and being ordered by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to cease using that name, Colasso took down the chamber's site and announced he has formed a new group called the Middle East Chamber of Commerce. The earlier chamber ran the Miss Middle East beauty pageant for years. Multiple contestants have recently filed suit with allegations that include fraud, photoshopping a dethroned beauty queen's face onto someone else's nude body in retaliation, and sexual harassment, including offering to trade sex for the crown. Colasso has denied all of those charges, and he has filed a countersuit. Union Tribune editorial and opinion editor Matthew Hall also exchanged emails with Colasso in preparation for an editorial that the newspaper subsequently ran. Colasso continued his name-calling and told Hall, "I don't do interviews with the UT." Councilman Colasso has also recently declined to respond to calls or emails from East County Magazine when we sought comments for recent stories, including this report. We sent a list of questions to Colasso at both his official city email address and his personal email account, allowing 24 hours for him to comment before publishing our article on his conflicts with the Union Tribune at eastcountymagazine.org, but he did not respond. The Union Tribune editorial board defended its reporter, who has previously been named Journalist of the Year by the Society of Professional Journalists in San Diego. A Union Tribune editorial excoriated Colasso, stating, "Declining comment in politics is one thing, but dripping contempt is something else. Colasso should dial it back. El Cajon's constituents are poorly served by his lack of professionalism." East County Magazine sent copies of the emails between Colasso and the Union Tribune reporter and editor to two First Amendment legal experts for comments. Terry Frank is general counsel at Californians Aware, or CalAware, an organization that protects open government access in California by reporters and the public. Regarding Colasso's threat to sue McDonald or the Union Tribune, Frank said he sees no significant likelihood that such a suit could possibly prevail. Frank states that Colasso admits he could not succeed with a libel suit because he could not prove deliberate lies, citing the high bar required for public figures to win a libel case. As for harassment, Frank adds, "I'm not aware of any case in which a court equated persistent or even obnoxious interview attempts by a journalist to be actionable." Frank further affirmed that a city councilman has no legal right to demand that a reporter not contact him. Moreover, he said, reporters have no obligation to heed Colasso's demand not to contact Colasso's wife, chamber officials, or members. Frank said he doubts that Colasso's actions would have a chilling effect on media, however, because, quote, No journalist worth his or her salt would be intimidated by such behavior. He also had a warning for Colosio. Anyone concerned about this should be aware that a legal action based on these circumstances would almost certainly be tossed out as a slap suit, which would mean the plaintiff would not only lose on the merits, but would have to pay the attorney fees of the defendant, Frank warned. SLAP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. A slap suit aims to suppress free speech rights under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the California Constitution. Slap suits are illegal in California. The California Anti-SLAP Project website states, slaps are often brought by corporations, real estate developers, or government officials and entities against individuals or organizations who oppose them on public issues. Now, we at East County Magazine also spoke with David Snyder. He's the executive director of the First Amendment Coalition regarding Colosio's actions. After reviewing those email exchanges published by the Union Tribune, Snyder says, first and foremost, it's a really depressing commentary on the level of discourse regarding and with the press that seems to have taken hold not just here but across the country. An apparent reference to claims of fake news by President Donald Trump and others who have tried to discredit media for even truthful and well-documented reporting. As for Colosio's remarks, Snyder states that an elected official would engage in such name-calling is disturbing, adding, the threats of litigation are also disturbing. Snyder calls Colosio's behavior extraordinarily irresponsible, adding, a public official should not be in the business of threatening groundless litigation over acts that are things that reporters do every day. He said, constant threats of baseless lawsuits can cast a real chill on the ability of reporters to just do their jobs and make it harder for reporters to hold public officials accountable for their actions, he adds. The First Amendment does not provide a blanket shield against otherwise unlawful behavior, such as assault or invading privacy of somebody's home, he clarifies. But he makes clear, just engaging in normal news gathering is not a crime and would be protected by the First Amendment. I can't imagine that any court would decide that sending emails and making phone calls asking about the government business of a public official could in any way rise to the level of an actionable claim, he says. The First Amendment Coalition leader adds it's not unlawful or unreasonable for a reporter to call a public official even at home regarding a news story. As for Colosio's demands not to contact himself, his wife, or chamber members, Snyder says that order is not enforceable. To prevent a reporter from making a phone call would be prior restraint, preventing speech before it happens, which is verboten, meaning forbidden. According to Cornell law, government action to prevent free speech is generally unconstitutional. The First Amendment Center's website states, perhaps no First Amendment right is more secure than the news media's right to publish information free from government censorship. According to the Reporters' Committee for Freedom of the Press, citing their First Amendment handbook, a prior restraint is an official government restriction of speech prior to publication. Prior restraints are viewed by the U.S. Supreme Court as the most serious and the least tolerable infringement on First Amendment rights. The court repeatedly has found that such attempts to censor the media are presumed unconstitutional. Snyder agrees with Frank about Colosio's threats to sue the Union Tribune based on what the emails disclosed. Snyder suggests that if Colosio filed a suit based on normal news-gathering activities, the chances of it being thrown out and of Colosio facing an anti-SLAPP suit would be very high. He adds, it would be subject to California's anti-SLAPP law, which requires the losing party, the person whose lawsuit is dismissed, to pay the lawyer fees for the defendant, in this case, the Union Tribune. Now, Colosio has claimed that the Union Tribune reporting was one-sided, and yet he has refused to answer important questions, as the email chains reveal. Reporters are not mind readers. The Union Tribune reporter and editor did give Colosio opportunities to share his perspectives, and he chose not to do so, for the recent stories at least. Colosio has claimed some information he provided previously was omitted from earlier stories. While that is possible, he has not provided any evidence to the Union Tribune editor to document that, or for that matter, to other media so far. Instead, he has opted to attack the press instead of taking responsibility for his own failure to respond to reasonable inquiries sent by the media. Snyder notes that Colosio has a right to express his views and says that if the councilman believes a report is inaccurate, he should raise his concerns to the reporter. If that does not resolve the concerns, then he should talk to the editor. But the First Amendment Coalition leader says that's not what Colosio has done, based on the information available. The First Amendment Coalition leader concludes, the claims of unfair coverage seem to be a front to engage in name-calling and avoid answering questions.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Gene Carpenter with a Crime Beat report. The owner of Spring Valley Greens, an illegal marijuana dispensary, also known as the Wax Room, has been arrested. 35-year-old Steve Tuma has been charged with opening a drug house, criminal conspiracy, and possession of marijuana for sale at the dispensary located on Campo Road in the Casa de Oro neighborhood of Spring Valley. The Sheriff's Rancho San Diego Crime Suppression Team and local detectives conducted a search back in July at Spring Valley Greens after receiving numerous complaints from concerned citizens over an illegal marijuana dispensary at the location, which is close to a school. Problems at the dispensary date back to at least December 2014, when a robbery suspect and a bystander were shot in connection with an armed robbery at the site.
This is Jonathan Getz reporting in La Mesa. Bugsy's Brew Coffee Shop has closed its doors 5 years after opening at the corner of La Mesa Boulevard and Jackson Drive. Bugsy's became a popular gathering place not only for coffee aficionados, but also musicians and music fans who came to enjoy local talent on open mic nights. A note taped to the door informs customers of the closing over the weekend, with a heavy heart but great memories. Owner Dan Moran thanked patrons, adding, "I'm sorry for having to move on, but my family is in need and I just focus on remaining active in my children's lives. Family first forever." East County Magazine interviewed Moran back in 2012, when the Java Joint had just opened with a slogan, "So good it should be illegal." Coffee drinks were named after famous gangsters such as Al Capone, Lucky Luciano, and Ma Barker. Moran said he named the place after his grandfather, George Bugs Moran, who ran Chicago bootlegging operations during Prohibition. His gang was gunned down in the notorious St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929. Reportedly on the orders of Al Capone. But ironically, Bugs Moran's life was spared, thanks to a coffee shop. Now his grandson's coffee shop, too, is relegated to the realm of history. You can view photos of the final night's open mic performances on September 16, 2017, on the Facebook photo album, The Last Night at Bugsy's. Linda Neumann, a longtime patron of Bugsy's, was there for the closing night. She posted on Facebook, "'Twas a sad evening, so hard to say goodbye to Bugsy's and all the good times we've had there."
A pilot and his passenger escaped without serious injury after the Piper single-engine plane in which they were traveling crashed onto 2nd Street at El Rey in front of the Church of Latter-day Saints in El Cajon Sunday afternoon. Heartland Fire and Rescue and San Miguel Fire Department responded swiftly to the scene, where the plane had apparently clipped power lines before coming to rest on its side. The pilot and passenger declined medical treatment at the scene. According to 10 News, the two men warned bystanders not to approach since fuel was leaking from the crashed plane. Heartland Fire reports that 20 to 30 gallons of fuel spilled, but firefighters were able to prevent an explosion. The plane was registered to Brian Fink of Ramona, who has already returned to work as an engineer at Qualcomm. The plane had reportedly taken off from Gillespie Field to Warner Springs when an engine failed, Epoch Times reports, citing Federal Aviation Administration spokesman Alan Kenitzer. The cause of the crash is under investigation by the FAA. This is John Fistier reporting from El Cajon.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Jonathan Getz with East County Magazine's People Power Report. It wasn't a typical purring engine sound coming from inside a Lexus car last weekend. After driving from his home in Morena Valley to his parents' residence in Spring Valley, Adrian Coralie heard meowing and realized that a cat had sneaked into the engine area. For 3 days, he and his parents tried to coax the cat out of the car, without success. Finally, Coralie stopped by San Miguel Fire District Station 15 to ask for help. Firefighters came to the rescue, discovering a kitten lodged under the vehicle's engine compartment. Firefighters used airbags to lift the car and disassemble parts of the Lexus. They climbed underneath to dislodge a tiny gray, white, and black kitten. The kitten was greasy from its 3-day car ride from Moreno Valley to Spring Valley while lodged in the engine compartment of the Lexus, but fortunately was unharmed. San Diego County Animal Services gave the kitten a clean bill of health. Coralie's next-door neighbor has adopted the kitten, which firefighters named Lexus in honor of the vehicle from which he was rescued.
This is Liz Alper with East County Magazine's Sports Report. Despite the Chargers hanging San Diego out to dry, new sports organizations are seeing San Diego for the premier sports destination it is. And now, a new face is entering America's finest city, and it's founded by an East County high school grad. The San Diego Kings are the newest team in San Diego and are in the American Basketball Association, or ABA. San Diego will now have two ABA teams, the original team being the San Diego Surf. The Kings were founded by entrepreneur, philanthropist, and El Cajon Valley High graduate Abraham Muhezi. According to its website, the mission of the Kings is, quote, to provide a high level of sports and entertainment for San Diego and the surrounding communities. Also, focusing heavily on getting involved in all communities to become the marquee professional team for San Diego. As a team playing in the American Basketball Association, we are dedicated to representing the ABA with class, integrity, and sound business practices, the website goes on to state. Our off-the-court continued goal is to enrich the lives of San Diegans and our student-athletes by providing life development skills, inspiration, and opportunities to further their educational development through the game of basketball. The team is co-owned by the top accident attorney in San Diego, Keen Ammon Port. The team will begin its inaugural season October 27th to the 29th at the Orange County Tournament.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes the Julian Apple Days Festival, an Apple Time Tea, Breakfast with Firefighters, outdoor concerts in El Cajon, and original dance performances in Bamboozled.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including Oktoberfests in La Mesa and El Cajon, a reception at Heritage of the Americas Museum for artist Padre Johnson, the Laguna Mountain Rendezvous, Kids Care Fest in Lakeside, and Borrego Days.
We also have Halloween happenings, including Hauntfest on Main, a Haunted Elks Lodge, a Halloween Harvest Festival on Mount Helix, a spooky campover at Lions, Tigers, and Bears, and the Boulevard Boo Parade. So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
If you love apples, the Julian Apple Days Festival on September 23rd and 24th is the place to be. Located at Mangini Winery in historic Julian, this event features Julian's famous apple pie, gold panning demonstrations, a falconry performance, live music and dancing, an antique tractor display, children's games and activities, a beer and wine garden, food and merchandise vendors, contests, and more. The festival harkens back to the early 1900s when Julian won a prestigious award from an apple growers association and started a fall Apple Day festival. The town now has a 2-month-long Apple Days celebration culminating with the Apple Festival this weekend and coronation of Mr. and Mrs. Apple Days. You can learn more at visitjulian.com. Just click on the calendar of events to find details on the Apple Days Festival and many more fall festivities.
As the days start to shorten and the mountain air turns nippy, our thoughts drift to warm drinks and apples, and then to Julian. Now you can indulge during the season with an apple-themed tea at Julian Tea and Cottage Arts. From September 21st through the 25th, they are offering an apple-themed menu highlighting that Julian specialty. Tucked away a block from busy Main Street in a historical home, their special tea features Hungarian apple soup, apple-themed finger sandwiches, scones with apple butter, an apple dessert, and, of course, fine teas. Vegetarian and gluten-free options are available with advance notice. Seatings are at 11:30 a.m., 1 p.m., and 2:30 p.m. For a menu and reservations, you can visit julientea.com.
This Saturday, San Miguel Fire District firefighters will be flipping pancakes and serving up breakfast in support of the San Miguel Firefighters Charitable Foundation. The breakfast will be held at the fire station on Clarendon Street in El Cajon from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. The San Miguel Firefighters Charitable Foundation provides financial support to local and national charities, also providing assistance to local fire victims.
El Cajon's Dinner and a Concert Series continues each Friday night through September at Promenade Park. You're invited to bring a picnic dinner or arrive early and dine at one of downtown El Cajon's restaurants before enjoying outdoor concerts from 6 to 8 p.m. Upcoming artists include the Petty Breakers on September 22nd, and on September 29th, the season finale with the Mighty Untouchables. For full details, visit downtownelcajon.com.
Kids Dance Company, the acclaimed children's dance troupe based in La Mesa, presents Bamboozled at the San Diego Performing Arts Center on Mission Gorge Place, September 22nd and 23rd at 7 p.m. Bamboozled is a celebration of love and all it encompasses, from sorrow and acceptance to family and human friendship. The show's numbers range from a celebration of Elton John works to Psalms for the Children of Syria, also including a fast-paced dance titled Tunisian Nights and Shimmy Sam, an upbeat tap number that just may have you dancing in your seats. Tickets to Bamboozled are available at visionarydancetheater.org.
Now for a preview of coming attractions.
Celebrating its 44th year, the popular La Mesa Oktoberfest will run from Friday, September 29th through Sunday, October 1st, bringing 3 days of Prost, or cheer. In addition to live German music and other entertainment, many vendors and crafts, you can also enjoy a beer garden serving up German and craft beers, plus, new this year, craft cocktails. For more information, you can go to lamesaoktoberfest.org.
The German American Club of San Diego hosts its annual Oktoberfest at its headquarters in El Cajon over 2 weekends, September 29th through October 1st, and again, October 6th through the 8th. You can feast on authentic German fare, from roast ox on a spit to German pancakes, sauerkraut, and bratwurst. A German band flown in from Bavaria will perform German music ranging from polkas and waltzes to beer drinking songs. You'll also find vendors selling a variety of crafts. For details, you can visit GermanClubSanDiego.org.
Heritage of the Americas Museum invites you to a reception with artist Padre Johnson on Friday, October 6th from 3 to 5 p.m. Padre Johnson will make a special presentation, donating 25 paintings from his Faces of the Global Human Family to the museum for permanent display. Padre Johnson started as a Navy Special Forces medical chaplain during the Vietnam War and later earned a doctorate in cultural anthropology. Research for his thesis led him to travel around the world painting faces of humanity. He spent 14 years living with people in 159 countries, capturing the common humanity in their faces. Now, he has put together an exhibition of his amazing works. His works have been exhibited at the United Nations and the Royal Palace in China's Forbidden City. Padre Johnson originally planned on gifting all of his paintings to the United Nations, but now he's decided that they belong at Heritage of the Americas Museum on the campus of Cuyamaca College right here in East County, where he held his very first exhibition years ago. For more information, you can visit heritageoftheamericasmuseum.com.
Step back in time to a fur trading and colonial camp from the 1700s through 1840s at the Laguna Mountain Rendezvous. This event takes place October 13th through the 22nd at the Mataguay Scout Reservation in Santa Isabel. You can see demonstrations of survival skills, such as cooking, archery, tomahawk throwing, black powder shooting, and tool making. For more information, you can visit the Laguna Mountain Rendezvous page on Facebook.
Grossmont Healthcare District presents Kids Care Fest on Saturday, October 14th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds. This event will offer potentially life-saving healthcare screenings as well as dental and vision screenings at no cost, plus safety demonstrations, flu shots, blood pressure and cholesterol checks, health information, and fun activities such as pony rides on a rock climbing wall. For details, you can visit kidscarefest.org.
The 6th annual Haunt Fest on Main will be held October 20th from 5 to 10 p.m. in downtown El Cajon. This fun, family-friendly, Halloween-themed event features live music on the promenade stage. This event also features costume contests on the Main Street stage, carnival rides, crafts, games, car show, a candy trail, kids zone with outdoor movies, face painting, inflatables for kids, pumpkin patch, Ghostbusters, and more. For more haunting details, you can visit hauntfest.org.
The 52nd annual Borrego Days Desert Festival kicks off Saturday, October 21st from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. and continues through Sunday, October 22nd. The Borrego Days Parade steps off at 10 a.m. on Saturday, October 21st, along Palm Canyon Drive and Christmas Circle in Borrego Springs, complete with pre-parade flyovers, floats, marching bands, and trick-riding Western cowboys. Borrego Days also includes arts and crafts and a carnival fun zone for kids both days, plus live music for dancing under the stars on Saturday night. For more information, you can visit borregodays.com.
The El Cajon Elks Lodge 1812 is teaming up with a local haunted house production company, Scare Ventures, to present a haunted lodge for the community in their parking lot from October 26th through the 31st. This will be one of the only haunted houses in San Diego's East County. The Haunted Lodge will feature a maze and four different key scare areas for guests to experience, plus activities and booths. There will also be early evening hours set aside for children under 12 to experience a less scary version of the Haunted Lodge that is family-friendly for youngsters, where they will be treated to Halloween candy from nicer monsters they encounter as a part of their tour through the lodge maze. The Elks, who have been serving the community for 60 years, will donate 100% of the proceeds from the event for children's charities. The lodge is located at 1500 East Washington Avenue in El Cajon. You can get advance tickets at elcajonelks.com.
The Mount Helix Park Foundation and Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association are joining together for a fun-filled Halloween Harvest Family Festival at the top of Mount Helix Park for neighborhood families on Sunday, October 29th from 2 to 5 p.m. A costume parade for kids, live music by Lenny and the Lounge Lizards, plus booths from local businesses offering crafts, games, and treats will all be part of this fall festival. You can park at the San Miguel Fire Station on Vivera to take a free shuttle to the top of Mount Helix. For details, visit mounthelixpark.org.
Lions, Tigers, and Bears in Alpine will host its annual Spooky Campover on Friday, October 27th through October 28th. Bring your own pumpkin to carve, food, camping gear, and best costume. This event promises a wild and ghoulish night under the stars with the rescued animals. There will be pumpkin carving, s'mores, campfire songs, a costume contest, and animal feedings. For reservations, visit lionstigersandbears.org.
The 13th annual Boulevard Boo Parade will be held Saturday, October 28th, starting at 10 a.m., with over 70 entries of live entertainment marching on 1 mile of El Cajon Boulevard in the college area, the parade will entertain you with spooky ghouls, goblins, ghosts, and witches to fill you with the Halloween spirit.
That's all for this week.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
A powerful 7.1 earthquake struck Mexico City, 32 years to the day that a 1985 quake killed 9,500 people and destroyed 100,000 homes in Mexico City. Since then, the city has made major efforts to improve earthquake safety standards. Thus far, the death toll stands at 225 people in yesterday's quake, including at least 21 children and 4 adults at the Enrique Reveseman School in Mexico City, which collapsed. rescue efforts continue, while another 30 children and 8 adults are still missing at the school, USA Today reports. The death toll includes 94 in Mexico City, as well as fatality in Morelos, Puebla, and Oaxaca. Hundreds more are injured. The quake comes on the heels of an 8.1 quake off the southern coast of Mexico just 2 weeks ago, as well as hurricanes that caused damage on Mexico's eastern shore. The earthquake has left about 40% of Mexico City and 60% of nearby Morelos state without power. Cell phone companies have been providing free service immediately after the quake. Authorities are asking people to keep phone lines open for emergency calls and to use social media or instant messaging to check on family or friends in the impacted areas, according to Reporting San Diego. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto has declared 3 days of national mourning while rescue efforts continue. U.S. President Donald Trump also tweeted condolences to the Mexican people. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on Hurricane Maria, the latest in a series of hurricanes to devastate islands in the Caribbean. The eye of Hurricane Maria passed almost directly over San Juan, the capital of Puerto Rico. The powerful storm has made landfall with 155-mile-an-hour winds, just 2 miles an hour short of Category 5 status. It's believed to be the strongest hurricane in at least 80 years to hit Puerto Rico, a U.S. territory that's home to 3.5 million people. For Puerto Rico, where the territorial government was already struggling to pay its bills after a decade-long depression, finding resources to help survivors rebuild will be challenging. Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, has asked President Trump to declare a disaster. Rosselló says up to 90% of the island's population is without power. Many homes and municipal buildings have been damaged across the island by high winds and flooding. Over 11,000 people have sought refuge in hundreds of shelters, some still reeling from the impacts of Hurricane Irma a week earlier, though Irma spared Puerto Rico a direct hit. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has indicated it has 3,200 personnel positioned to help after the storm. Maria will most likely turn northward, but is not expected to hit the eastern seaboard of the United States, according to the National Hurricane Center. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is John Fastier with a Capitol Report. Like the proverbial Lazarus rising from the dead, efforts to repeal Obamacare have been revived. Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy have introduced a measure that would repeal Obamacare with no replacement. The bill would instead give block grants allowing states to let insurance companies deny coverage or charge more for pre-existing conditions and to eliminate lifetime caps on coverage for people needing costly care to survive. It also cuts funds for Medicaid expansion and eliminates all subsidies for low and moderate income Americans. Medical organizations and patient advocacy groups say the bill is even worse than one defeated this summer by a single vote. Late night host Jimmy Kimmel has blasted the bill and co-author Bill Cassidy for lying to the audience on his show. At the same time, Kimmel's newborn son had just undergone heart surgery to save his life. Cassidy said in considering any future health care measures, he would ask, does it pass the Jimmy Kimmel test? Would the child born with a congenital heart disease be able to get everything she or he would need in the first year of life? The new bill would not protect newborn children or people of any age with serious medical conditions. Earlier, Republican measures to repeal Obamacare would have kicked 30 to 40 million Americans off of health care coverage completely, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Republicans have refused to wait for the Congressional Budget Office to analyze their latest bill. Polls have shown that only 12% of Americans supported the last repeal bill, which got rid of the unpopular mandate under Obamacare, but also eliminated many provisions that helped tens of millions of Americans. The new bill has no assurances of medical coverage for those who cannot afford premium costs or have pre-existing conditions. Kimmel responded angrily to news of Cassidy's co-authorship of the new bill, stating of Congress, "They're taking care of the people who give them money, the insurance companies." The key votes on the new bill are again expected to be Republican Senators John McCain from Arizona, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, and Susan Collins from Maine, who, along with Kentucky's Rand Paul, were the only Republicans to oppose the last bill. All Democrats say they will vote no on the new measure, as they did on the earlier repeal effort. Republicans have until September 30th to ram it through without Democrats having the ability to block it through a filibuster due to a special budgetary rule. They are attempting to pass the bill with only a single hearing in a Homeland Security Committee, not a Health Committee. The only testimony that the chairman has said he will allow is from the authors of the bill. While there is a bipartisan group of senators working separately on a measure that would address shortfalls in Obamacare without taking away protections that it did provide, as well as more liberal proposals such as Medicare for All bills that Senator Bernie Sanders has introduced with 15 Democratic co-authors, the Republican leadership in Congress has refused to allow debate on any of those measures. Jimmy Kimmel, meanwhile, has invited Senator Cassidy to come back on his show and take what he calls the new Jimmy Kimmel test, a lie detector.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, September 22nd, 2017. I'm Eric Tegedoff. The news we're following on today's rundown: Facebook turns over Russia-linked ads to Congress. How Senate Republicans' new health care bill could hurt the fight against the opioid epidemic, and Texas food banks prepare to serve the long-term needs of Harvey victims. Facebook has announced it will turn over more than 3,000 Russia-linked ads to congressional committees investigating the country's influence on the 2016 election. The tech company has been under greater scrutiny over the past 2 weeks after admitting Russia agents covertly bought ads on the site. Facebook, as well as Twitter, have also turned over data to Special Investigator Robert Mueller, who is looking into ties between Russia and the Trump campaign. The health care bill Senate Republicans are rushing to finish could cripple the nation's opioid treatment and end Medicaid expansion, according to an analysis. We go to Dan Hyman in West Virginia for more.
Sean O'Leary is with the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. He says the last-ditch attempt to get a GOP-only Obamacare repeal through the Senate would cut Medicaid funding so much the state would have to roll back expansion. Plus, O'Leary says, while Senator Shelley Moore Capito negotiated added funding for opioid treatment in previous Affordable Care Act repeal bills, there is none in this legislation.
There is no extra money for opioids. There's nothing. So it could really, really have a really devastating impact on the state's battle against opioid addiction.
Supporters of what's known as the Cassidy-Graham bill say changing Medicaid funding to a block grant system would give the states flexibility to do more with less.
The chairman for the Federal Communications Commission wants to redefine broadband by lowering the standard for speed, a move advocates for affordable access say will hurt rural Americans the most. We go to Kentucky for this report.
The regulatory agency currently defines home broadband at 25 megabits per second. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai wants to substitute cellular services, the new standard, at 10 megabits a second. Kate Forsey with the advocacy group Public Knowledge says mobile internet is not a sufficient replacement for fixed broadband to the home.
It's very difficult to stream University of Kentucky basketball, but also more fundamental needs like applying for jobs, for kids to do their homework and file book reports or do research.
But Pai maintains wireless is a viable substitute. Public Knowledge filed its response to the FCC proposal Thursday, joining a flood of other comments opposing the lower standards. I'm Greg Stottlemyre reporting.
After the initial influx of food and other donations for Hurricane Harvey victims, Southeast Texas food banks are now preparing to serve the region's long-term needs.
While most of the emergency shelters have cleared out, thousands of people returned to flood-damaged or destroyed homes or lost their jobs and need help putting food on the table. Brian Green with the Houston Food Bank, one of several in the 39-county region affected by the storm, says food banks may need to provide food assistance for many thousands of flood victims for as long as a year or more.
We have been distributing through a network of about 270 partner distribution sites that agreed to step up and help the people in their neighborhoods. The immediate aftermath has been extremely busy, so our challenge is going to be sustainability.
He says after Harvey, trucks began arriving from all over the country with food and other supplies. He expects the challenge to be that as the level of donations taper off, the need for food assistance across the region will remain high.
That was Mark Richardson reporting. I'm Eric Tegedoff for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news across our border region.
A bill that would lead to the proliferation of refrigerator-sized 5G cell tower boxes across the state is now on Governor Jerry Brown's desk, and health advocates are pressing for a veto. SB 649 would allow telecom companies to install 5G and other wireless cell equipment on poles and on the ground every few hundred feet without getting a permit from the local jurisdiction, cutting off public input. Ellen Marks with the California Brain Tumor Association says there haven't been any studies to prove 5G is safe, but studies have shown that older, less powerful cell technology can have serious health effects.
There's a U.S. National Toxicology Program that was released last year that found that 2G was causing brain tumors and tumors near the heart in laboratory animals. So employing 5G without any knowledge of health effects is not a good idea.
The bill requires cities to allow large equipment boxes in the public right-of-way, so Marks says they could end up in front of homes, schools, libraries, and parks, but not fire stations because firefighters have been given an exemption due to health concerns. The Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association says the boxes are safe and will introduce super-fast wireless internet across the state. Dozens of cities protested after the state assembly passed the bill last week. Marks notes that Brown is now the only hope of stopping it.
Our legislators took about $2.5 million from telecom in their last election. I don't think the governor is concerned about campaign contributions any longer, so hopefully he does what's right for the state.
Brown has until next week to sign the bill, veto it, or let it become law without his signature. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Back in the saddle for our next conversation is Gary McClintock, founder of McClintock Saddleworks in Descanso. Gary is famous for his beautiful custom-made saddles with their gleaming leather and hand-tooled detailing. But he is equally famous for his knowledge of the world of Los Vaqueros, the cowboys of the Southwest and Mexico. Gary, welcome back.
Thanks, Helen. It's really great to be back with you. I enjoy being around you. You're such a lovely, vivacious person that it always is encouraging to me.
Oh, gee willikers. Now tell me, cowboys in general have such a hold on the American psyche. For you, what is it about the story of the vaquero that is so compelling?
You know, I think where that started for me was with Granville Martin, who I came to know. I wasn't that thrilled and overwhelmed with the cowboy as a rodeo cowboy. I was more interested in the guy that rode the backcountry and handled cattle and maybe had a little small ranch. You know, what we were presented during the 50s and all the cowboy shows that were on TV, that just sounded like a great way to live. You know, that was exciting. Not necessarily the rodeo cowboy, but the ranch cowboy. That's what got my attention. And when I met Granny, he introduced me to the whole world of the California vaquero, which was a whole different way of doing things than even the Texas cowboy.
Gary, for our listeners, Granville or Granny Martin is a historian?
Yeah, he was a great historian. He didn't plan to be that way, but he just got all wrapped up in everything. First, he was a rancher, a vaquero is what he called himself. They wouldn't go, they would go vaquero and not cowboy, and he would always refer to it that way because it was a little bit different way of handling cattle and being that type of a range cowboy is what he was.
It sounds like you're referring to the vaquero as a kind of steward of the land.
That's
a different thing altogether.
definitely a steward of the land. You know, if you look to what an environmentalist is today, they had to be that way. They had to make the land produce for them. If the land wasn't taken care of, it wouldn't produce. Of course, you had to have rain, which is what they all pray for, to make the grass grow. But they were very essential stewards of the land that preserved the land for us to what we really, it's been abused, so it's not as nice as it was in their day. I mean, there's a different philosophy that's out there with the different agencies of the government as far as how the backcountry should be handled. But in his day, it was the cattlemen that were foremost survivors. I mean, it was a ranching community, a ranching society that existed with 90% of the people living out on the land, where today it's reversed. You know, it's probably 99% of the people live.
So we're talking about a whole ranching society in parts of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and spilling over the border.
Oh, yeah.
Into Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico is really where it all comes from. And that, you know, as they moved north back in the 1700s, they settled California and they settled New Mexico. They settled Arizona. And that was the only thing there was to do, is raise cattle. And you needed horses, so they raised horses as well. That was like making automobiles in that day. You had to have good horses, so along with the cattle came the good horses.
So there's a big Spanish colonial backstory.
Absolutely.
To the world of the vaqueros.
Oh,
because,
that's who it is.
Like, where do horses come from?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good question. But they introduced the, as far back as the, when Cortez came. Cortez was the one that introduced horses in 1519. Yeah. He brought, I don't know, maybe 19 or 20 horses with him. They were in Hispaniola before that, down by Cuba, and some were in Cuba. They were starting to raise them there. They were getting ready for a intrusion, an entrada into Mexico. It wasn't Mexico at the time. It became Nueva España to them,
yes.
But it was just a big land mass out there that they wanted to explore.
And those horses then multiplied, or they ran away?
No, they were very well under control. The end of breeding program came along with that. That's
okay.
Those particular, there was a breeding program in the islands down by Hispaniola. That's why they had the horses there. They were breeding them there.
Oh,
and then as they
know.
Brought them over and they had the opportunity, once the conquest was done, which didn't take much, they started breeding, and some went to South America, some went to North America. So different breeding programs went throughout all of Mexico.
So it's fair to say that we have historic horses, that the vaqueros you're talking about in a contemporary sense are actually riding and herding on horses with this long pedigree.
Well, it's so mixed at this time, it's really hard to... What you say is true if you look to the Mustang. That probably has more of the Andalusian, the Lusitanos, the horses that came with the conquest. Those were the horses that propagated, and they did run loose after a while, but that was later. You know, at first, they all had to run loose because they didn't have fences. You know, they had to eat, so they let them run loose. But that's when the Indians got all the horses. They stole them from the Spanish and started their own breeding program.
Ah, yeah.
See, they really had no horses to speak of until, really, Father Kino came into what they called Pimeria Alta, which is the northern part of Mexico and the southern part of Arizona and New Mexico.
And Father Kino is?
Kino's the one, a Jesuit priest that introduced all that. And he had very little protection, but had a lot of livestock, a lot of cattle. And he introduced it to the Indians. He wanted them to propagate them. He wanted them to get involved with ranching. And they did.
Father Kino was a Jesuit, so he predated Father Sarah, who
absolutely.
Was Franciscan. Yeah,
yes.
There was a kind of warfare between the two orders. If I'm recalling this correctly, Royal Spain removed the Jesuits.
That's exactly right. They
sent in the Franciscans.
Became very jealous of the Jesuits. Carlos III, the king over there in Spain, was thinking that the Jesuits were taking advantage of him and holding back from him taxes or gold or something. And in reality, they really were not. They had very little, and they were a very selfless people. They lived for Indians that they were trying to convert.
Gary, you mentioned fencing, and there is that old song, "Don't Fence Me In," yeah. And which is kind of the anthem,
yeah.
The national anthem for a cowboy or a vaquero. Yeah. And really, in point of fact, for a modern vaquero, how much fencing is there? Is there room to be a vaquero?
You know, Helen, that's a great observation, because it's literally gone. There's very few places where you have open range. I mean, there's some of that some places, but nothing like what was back during that era. I mean, the whole world moved on horseback. The horses were trained so well because there were so many of them to select from to begin with, after they perpetuated, especially in California. The great horse herds just multiplied. They dissolved the missions in 1835, so about that, before that point, maybe between 1820 and 1835 was when there was such a entourage of horses grazing throughout California and the Southwest. Well, from that, they could make a good horse because they had nothing but cattle and horses. And cattle, working cattle with a young horse gives them a reason to turn, to stop, to go, to back up, to do all the different things that we require of a well-trained horse. It just came from natural working. One horse might be better than another because of natural selection. One was just a little bit better than the other one at doing this. And as a consequence, if they could perpetuate that, they would. But they didn't necessarily ride the mares.
In the folklore of the cowboy and the vaquero, is there anything similar to the rules of the road for cars and boats, where you have to give way? So say two vaqueros are meeting on a narrow trail on a mountain grade. Who gets to go first?
Probably not so much of a reality. Some situations would develop that way. There is some etiquette regarding the herdsmen who are handling the stock, cattle, sheep, goats, whatever it is. There is kind of a rite of passage, like if you're working the right side of the herd, you don't cross in front of the guy that's working to the left of you. He shifts to the left and you go with him.
Okay.
More like a dance, you know, instead of crossing in front of each other.
Okay. Is that where do-si-do comes from?
I don't know. It could be.
Are you saying that it's the tradition of the vaquero is handed down in families?
Oh, absolutely. From generation to generation. In fact, we made a video about the cowboys in Baja, and it kind of goes into a little of that and how it was from father to son. The tradition was handed down. I mean, it was unfortunate for those who didn't have as much land. They couldn't get it handed to them like me. I wasn't in a family of that, so I kind of was left out of that.
I've seen that. I've seen that film, and it's 1 hour, and it's very good. Gary, you are terrific. Thank you so much for stopping by. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.